and welcome to Small Town Mysteries, a show where three longtime friends from Massachusetts tell crazy and heartbreaking true stories filled with the extra flair of small town mystery. I'm Kate, here with Christine.
Hello.
And Rachel.
Hello.
Bringing you our next episode on the harrowing crimes of Brian Cohey. But before we get into that, I'm going to toss it over to Rachel, who is highlighting our missing person for this week. Rach?
Today I am covering the disappearance of Solmi Veronica Cal Peck. She's 13 years old. She's female, Hispanic. She's missing from Livingston, Tennessee. She was last seen on February 22nd, 2024. She is 4 feet 10 inches tall, weighs about 120 pounds. She has black hair and black eyes. She was last seen wearing plaid pajama pants and a sweatshirt. If you have seen Solmi or have information regarding her whereabouts, please contact the Livingston Police Department at 913-823-6496 or TBI at 1-800-TBI-FIND. We will be posting a picture of Solmi on our Instagram at Small Town Mysteries Pod. Check that out. And remember, no tip is too small. And thank you.
So I don't know if you guys have seen anything about this case. I have seen it. It was like the first thing on my TikTok For You page when I logged in a few days ago. A documentary just came out this past Sunday on YouTube covering this case, and it led to a lot of clickbaity TikTok type true crime material. So we're going to talk about this case. And I also want to give a serious content warning. This is one of the most gruesome cases that I've covered. So I will throw that out there before I get started. One fateful day in 2021, Terry Cohey entered her son's bedroom with a sinking feeling in her stomach. She approached his closet cautiously, knowing that she did not want to know the truth of what was inside. She took the lid off of a large Rubbermaid container, moved the two trash bags inside to her kitchen sink, and began to open them. Terry Cohey will never live another day of her life without that horrific image in her head. In the bags were a human head and two hands. Terry's son had murdered a man.
Oh my, that's scarring.
Yes.
Could you imagine just like cleaning like your son's room and then just, it's like incomprehensible. Like I can't even think about that.
So this case has been all over my TikTok and like Instagram reels this week because, as I said, a documentary on YouTube was just released covering this case. I do have to give the necessary caveat that I did not have a chance to watch the documentary myself. So I saw a few key clips in my research. Otherwise, I cannot vouch for the veracity of the documentary or how it handles some particularly troubling subject matter. So please approach that with caution if you do choose to watch. It's on the YouTube channel Explore With Us and is about 2 hours long. They are known for proactive research into recent cases, and they did acquire a lot of this material using FOIA requests, which is the Freedom of Information Act. So you basically just petition the government, like if it's publicly available documentation, they have to send it to you. So they actually were the first source to have a lot of the dash cam footage and interview room footage for this case. I imagine that a lot of the heavy hitters like Dateline in 2020, once they get their hands on it, this case is going to have like multiple television specials as well. But like I said, they were proactive. They got the FOIA requests in and they got the documents here. So they got it first. But as I said, can't vouch for the veracity, can't vouch for exactly how they handle the subject matter. So please approach that with caution. The setting for this case is Grand Junction, Colorado. It's a city. I'm not going to dwell on it because I don't care. It's actually the biggest and most populous city in all of Western Colorado. Oh, well, moving on. As with many areas in Colorado, Grand Junction is known for its stunning landscapes and national parks. On February 27th, 2021, Brian Cohey, some websites said that he was Brian Cohey Jr., and some said he was Brian Cohey II. I'm not sure which one of those is accurate. I'm going to call him Brian Cohey.
Aren't those the same thing?
Yeah, but they would be like different legal names.
Hmm.
Like being a junior and being a second would be like listed differently on like a birth certificate.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Brian Cohey was 19 years old and admittedly a bit of a loner. As the courts would soon come to know deeply and personally, Brian Cohey had been diagnosed as, quote, level one autistic. I know these levels, to my knowledge, are not commonly used anymore. Christine, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right. They're not.
Okay. So, you know, modernly, autism is viewed as a spectrum. Brian was diagnosed in 2019, which I would obviously say would be considered modern, but that was the terminology that the counselor who made the diagnosis used. She used the terminology like mildest and highest functioning. But once again, I'm putting those in quotation marks because that terminology is defunct and not really used anymore.
I actually think they do still like diagnose, so I don't think that's necessarily wrong.
Okay.
With levels, but it's just not really, what is the term when it's not used outside? It's not used like
colloquially?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so like as a diagnostic term,
mm-hmm.
it's still, okay, that makes a lot more sense because I was sort of wondering about that because I know just from past experiences that that terminology is sort of outdated in many regards, but that's a good explanation. I appreciate that. A young woman who worked with Brian at a Safeway gas station said that Brian became more talkative, closer to the crimes, and he often talked about not having any real friends, saying that people who were friendly with him were, quote, only his friends out of pity. Prior to the murder that he committed in early 2021, Brian had seen several doctors and psychologists, especially in the wake of his uncle's death. Brian's family physician, Dr. Craig Gustafson, treated Brian for depression in 2018 and continued to see him for several years after that. Despite some physical ailments that he sought medical help for, Dr. Gustafson said he never had any particular reason to think that Brian was dealing with suicidal ideation. And despite Brian's reports of frequent headaches in 2020, an MRI found no tumors or clots that would explain that or could have possibly caused behavioral changes. Just days before the murder, Dr. Gustafson saw Brian, who had come to him with an abscess under his armpit. At that time, the doctor reported no appearance of psychotic behavior, which turned out to be very relevant at trial. Brian also saw Bea Phillips, a counselor, for about 25 sessions between 2017 and 2019. In some of these sessions, Brian asked Phillips why hurting and stealing from others was considered, quote, a big deal, stating that it's, quote, what we're supposed to do. She further said that he seemed to know the difference between right and wrong despite making those statements.
It just, that seems odd to me.
What?
Why hurting and stealing from others was considered a big deal, that it's what we're supposed to do. That statement of it's what we're supposed to do sounds odd.
I agree. He thought hurting and stealing from others was like part of human creation. It was in the context of a discussion of Darwinism.
Oh, okay.
Which I guess puts it into perspective a little bit more, but it, right. It does kind of show that like callousness almost.
Okay. Like the Darwinism does provide some context.
But still,
I guess in the past, that is historically what people have done in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're right. The way he's just so nonchalant about it is concerning.
Alarming. Yes. And Brian's mother also noticed this sort of alarming rhetoric. So in 2019, she took him to the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation to be assessed, because he had admitted to her that he, quote, felt ambivalent about his uncle's death. Like, he kind of just didn't care, and he was tired of pretending that he did. During this assessment, Dr. Katrina Catton, I'm going to say Catton, we're going to go with that, asked Brian about his future goals, and his response was alarming. He listed a number of historical figures known for committing objective atrocities, people that most would say are horrible, and like exclusively known for their destructive acts, such as Hitler, Stalin, the Columbine shooters, and Ted Bundy, and said that he idolized them.
Okay. I hope that you're going to go into this, but did the doctor do anything after that?
No, I think you know the answer. No. So, oh, I mean,
the little chuckle said it all.
Yeah, basically what I found was that she did refer him outwardly. But then there was no, I couldn't find any information about further treatment that was sought after that. So all of this was reported, like I was able to find info on like this particular meeting. And then, like, Brian's mother also talked about, like, mental health access and things like that. So it sounded to me like she was clearly aware that there was a problem and that she was seeking help for him. But I couldn't find anything concrete to indicate that he received further treatment or assessment after seeing Dr. Catton.
That is just such a major red flag.
I agree.
Huge. When you're idolizing those people, that's scary. And he's literally, like, laying it out for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right there. And
yeah,
just...
I don't think he could have been any more clear with his intentions. You ask him about his future plans, and he starts talking about the Columbine shooters.
Yeah. Yikes.
So I find this background to be crucially important to understanding the way that the trial went, because Brian never claimed that he didn't commit the crime that he was accused of, but he claimed that he was not guilty by means of mental defect. I'll talk about that in a little more detail later, but I do have to rewind a bit and let's talk about the crime. So as many of the people listening know, I am not, my type of content does not get into the gruesome details. It's just not how I prefer to consume or create true crime content. I don't like the ick factor. That doesn't usually pull weight with me. So I'm just not going to delve into the grossness. I will say I'll have brief mentions of specific gruesome acts, but you won't get any detail. You can find anything related to this case in much more detail all over the internet, and I don't feel the need to rehash it here. So this is bare bones. It's literally going to be a sentence. On February 27th, 2021, Brian murdered, dismembered, decapitated, and attempted to dispose of part of the body of Warren Barnes, age 69. Barnes, a local homeless man, was known for his love of reading and outgoing personality. He was a well-known man around town, affectionately called the Reading Man. And in his honor, they actually did set up a small statue of a stack of books.
That's so sad. The Reading Man.
I know.
So what? Would he just like walk? I see a person actually on my way back from work, and he's a younger guy, but he's literally just always walking somewhere and holding a book and just reading it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think about. Like, this guy was just going around town walking and reading at the same time.
Yeah, that was definitely the impression I got. This man was known in the community. He was known locally. He was homeless, but people knew who he was. He was friendly, outgoing, always chatty, and always had something nice to say. Loved to listen to the birds, loved to read, like just an all-around good person who happened to be homeless, which unfortunately is why Brian targeted him. Brian chose Warren because he thought police would be less likely to investigate the disappearance of a homeless man. Like, he kind of thought they wouldn't care, and he thought that he would get away with it because... who cares about homeless people? But he was so beyond wrong. Warren was a local fixture in the community. He was well-known and well-loved. A nearby shop owner called police to report him missing not long after he was last seen because his habits were known and his presence, or lack thereof, was noted immediately. Despite what Brian thought, the police immediately delved into this case and the community cared deeply about Warren Barnes. And his... logic there is so horrible in general. And even if he had picked someone who perhaps the community didn't know as well or wasn't as outwardly social just because they were homeless, that wouldn't lessen his crime at all. And he definitely seemed to be of the mindset that killing a homeless person was like not as bad as killing anyone else. And I find that disgusting.
That's horrible. I mean, his thought process was also probably that he assumed, kind of like you were saying, that people, not even people didn't see him, but like he didn't have a family or people who cared about him.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, I'm really glad that he was proved wrong.
I'm very glad. Yeah. And that's, I talk at the end about how there's not a ton of like, nothing about this case is satisfying. I wouldn't ever use that terminology. But something about him being so wrong in his motive for, like, choosing a particular person and the community coming forward in droves to prove just how wrong he was, that feels a little better. After placing part of Warren's body in the Rubbermaid container where his mother eventually recovered it, he took Warren's torso and attempted to throw it into a lake. But apparently his car got stuck in the mud, which sucks. On March 1st, Brian's mother made her harrowing discovery and immediately called police. For anyone who thinks they can stomach it, this is certainly not me. I have skipped over this video on TikTok very intentionally multiple times. The audio of his mother's call to police is included in the YouTube documentary that I mentioned earlier. And it's horrible. It's some of the worst true crime content I've ever heard. So, as I said earlier, please approach that at your own risk if you think that is something that you can handle and want to hear. Police met Brian in the driveway, where they had an insanely chilling conversation. When asked if police might find anything in his room, Brian said, quote, "I believe so." When they asked what they would find, he replied, "A human head and hands."
I'm not surprised, based on what you've said about him before, how nonchalant he was about that.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still shocking that a human being could be that nonchalant about something like that.
And it's, I have seen that clip because I scrolled onto it and didn't know what it was and couldn't scroll away fast enough to like not watch it. And yeah, it's eerie. He definitely looks almost smug. And I don't say that lightly. Like, I don't want to like use terminology that makes him seem worse than he is for what he did. But he legitimately seemed like smug. Like, yeah, I believe so. You're going to find a human head and hands. Like, he didn't care at all, which is crazy. So by his own word, Brian killed Warren because he wanted to know what killing felt like, and he chose Warren because he thought no one would care about a homeless man. Of course, as a legal nerd, I find the trial strategy of the defense team very interesting here. So, not guilty by reason of insanity or mental defect, the particular terminology there varies by jurisdiction, is what is called an affirmative defense, meaning that it essentially comes as an admission, but with the caveat that the insanity or mental defect in question negates the required intent to prove guilt. Because when you prove that someone committed a crime, you have to prove that they intended to commit the crime. This takes out that element of intent and says, like, yeah, he killed the guy, but he didn't mean to because of mental illness or defect. I'm not sure how much sense that makes to people who haven't sat through, like, extensive criminal law and procedure lectures, but it's kind of like a yes, but defense. In Colorado, a plea of not guilty by reason of mental defect is defined by the defendant's ability to differentiate from right and wrong at the time that the crime is committed. As I said, other states have slightly different standards. And as I mentioned earlier, Brian's family doctor, Dr. Gustafson, treated Brian just days before the murder and claimed that he was, quote, definitely not psychotic. But this is still days before the murder. The standard requires the insanity be present at the time of the commission of the crime. So while it might be helpful to know that he was not in any particular state of psychosis or depression when he saw Dr. Gustafson days before, that actually has no bearing on what his mental state was at the time of the murder itself.
How can you prove that if you don't see a doctor the day of? Or is it appropriate for other witnesses to comment on? I was going to ask if it had to be a person who knew about and had an education regarding like mental illness, or
so
if it
basically
could just kind of be.
No, so it would be like testimony about his behavior the day of would be really helpful, like anything that they can get from his parents, for example. And definitely coming from the doctor, that's not unhelpful. It's just that it's not the day of. So you do have to consider the attenuation there, that there's like time between when that judgment was made and when the crime occurred that could have changed certain factors or situations. But it is still helpful for the jury to know. And in a jury trial, what I'm going to get into now is they both sides, prosecution and defense, both relied on expert psychologists in their argument. And that actually comes down to the jury to decide the weight of the evidence. So both people can provide their testimony. And, you know, someone hired by the prosecution is going to testify in a way that supports the prosecution's argument. Someone hired by the defense is going to testify in a way that supports the defense's argument. But it's up to the jury to decide the weight of the evidence provided by those two experts and decide, like, who they believe more, basically, if that makes sense. So there's a lot of factors that go into that determination of, like, intent. Like, can we prove that he intended to do this at the time it happened? And the defense's job is to be like, no, you can't prove that, and give examples of why intent should be negated. And then the prosecution rebuts and is like, here's why you're wrong. So the prosecution called Thomas Gray, a psychologist with the Colorado Behavioral Office, who testified that he believed Brian was able to distinguish between right and wrong at the time of the murder. I was not able to find any more detail on this. I'm hoping when the court documents come out, I can read that specific testimony. The defense called psychologist Paul Sprague, who argued that Brian was experiencing a major depressive episode that, quote, overrode his ability to know right from wrong. So they're both using the very technical terminology of the legal standard, which is common and makes sense. So as I said, when two expert witnesses are pit against each other like that, the jury is the ultimate arbitrator of whose testimony is like more correct or more reliable. In Brian's case, the jury agreed with the prosecution, and after 2 days of deliberation, they ruled that Brian Cohey knew what he was doing when he killed Warren Barnes, and that he knew it was wrong. Brian Cohey was found guilty in early 2023 of the murder of Warren Barnes, as well as tampering with his body. The family of Warren Barnes came out in full force at Brian's sentencing hearing in February of 2023. Warren's sister Geraldine spoke of her last conversation with Warren just 1 day before he died. He had called her for her birthday. She expressed, quote, a deep sense of loss and sadness at not being able to speak with her brother again. Warren's niece focused on not only the pain that Brian had caused to her family, but the damage that his crime would cause for everyone in the ADHD or autism spectrum disorder communities, that it would possibly contribute to negative opinions of people overall with autism or ADHD because of his particular actions. She also told him that he would be a burden to Colorado taxpayers for every day of the rest of his life, which is a true testament. People bring that up often with life sentences versus death penalty arguments, like how expensive it is to have someone serve life in prison as the burden falls on taxpayers. But I really appreciate her saying that directly to him, saying like, you in particular, you're a burden. You did this and now we have to pay and we hate you for that. Like, excellent. Another relative reminded Brian that Warren's life was important and he was not a throwaway person. Though homeless, he lived a rich life full of books, birds, and his community. Warren Barnes was remembered for his usual reply to good morning. He always said, and you also.
Oh, such a formal king.
Right?
I love that.
Brian Cohey's mother, Terry, made a statement as well, in which she apologized to Warren's family for what her son had done and apologized to the jury for having to view such disturbing evidence in deciding the case. She begged for better mental health care, hoping that something like this can be prevented in the future. The judge in this case, Judge Richard Gurley, said this was one of the most horrific cases he had ever encountered in his 37 years with the court system. He sentenced Brian to life in prison, plus an additional 13 and a half years without parole. Brian Cohey will die in prison with a bed, some space to himself, and meals provided. Warren Barnes was killed because of what he didn't have. A bed, some space to himself, maybe not consistent access to meals. And because of one man's misunderstanding of the impact that one person can have on an entire community. And this, I think, is a strong example of a case where justice has been served in the most technical sense, but the wrongs committed by Brian Cohey will never truly be fixed. Warren Barnes will never read another book or close his eyes to listen to the bird sounds. It's justice, but it is not vindication. It is not closure. It is not healing. It is a failure of many to protect the life of one. The failure of doctors, psychologists, parents, colleagues to recognize and effectively address troublesome behavior before it can deepen. It is a failure of everyone who could have helped Brian Cohey, and it is a failure of everyone who didn't. It is a failure. And that's my case.
I don't even have words. It's so upsetting that like people are still targeted for like their social economic status, and people think that they'll be forgotten about. And like, I feel like that's just such a barbaric way to think.
I agree. Barbaric is a great word for it. Just to assume that someone's life has less value because of their economic situation is mind-boggling to me.
I feel like we've also talked a few times on the podcast about the failure of a group of people to do something. And it's like, mm-hmm. how can all of these people have these red flags and just not do anything? And maybe right. part of it is that, like, you know, all people do have like a piece of that, and they might not have the full picture. But even in this case, the stuff that you mentioned, I mean, something should have been done. But
right.
I also do wonder if part of it is almost like the bystander effect or something similar, mm-hmm. where like people might think, yeah, that's a red flag, but then someone else is going to do something about it. Like, you said that the psychologist referred him to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm going to refer him to someone else, and they're going to do something about it and kind of like brush it off their hands.
Kind of like pass the hot potato.
Yeah.
Make it someone else's problem for now.
Pass the book.
Yeah.
Obviously,
to use a more technical term.
In cases like these, you don't just have time to mm-hmm. go around and do that and wait for someone to do something about it, because
right.
you never know when a person like that is going to commit a crime.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is so tricky about it, is everyone I listed there, the doctors, psychologists, parents, colleagues, it doesn't fall on any one of them individually. It's not like I can point the finger directly at his mother and say, this is your fault, because it's not. She's not the one who committed the crime. But should she have pushed a little more aggressively to get him diagnosed and treated? Maybe. I never read a single thing about his dad. What does dad have to do with this? You know, is dad playing a role in the household that created a nurturing environment for him to grow up in? Or, you know, is something else going on there that could be negatively impacting him? His colleague noticing the way that his behavior changed closer to the crimes, that's not necessarily on her to like contact police and be like, hey, I work with this guy at a gas station and he's suddenly really friendly and it's weird. That's not individually on her, but as a collective, this is a failure. But I agree that it's a tough situation, because you can't individually point a finger like that. You just can't. It's systemic. It never just comes down to one person. Well, I have a full list of sources here that will be included in the information wherever you stream your podcasts. I did not link the YouTube documentary, but if you look up Brian Cohey, it's literally the first thing that comes up on YouTube. So if you choose to view that, that's how you would find it. But once again, I have not seen that myself. I cannot testify to how it approached the subject matter. And I can't guarantee it handled it the same way that I did. So just go into that knowing full well that it may very well be a little clickbaity true crime content, which I know we personally try to avoid. But that is all I have on Brian Cohey and Warren Barnes.
Thank you for all of your research, Kate.
Yeah, thank you. We really did handle that with care.
Thank you. So, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Small Town Mysteries. If you want to drop us a line, we are on Instagram at Small Town Mysteries Pod. We will also have information there on the missing person that Rachel highlighted at the beginning of the episode. If you choose to check that out, maybe you live in the area or surrounding area and you want to check that out, please do so. If you live in a small town, live near a small town, have heard of a small town, wish you lived in a small town, or one time saw a story about a weird small town on the news, we'd love to hear about it and maybe even cover it. I know in this episode, I very much blew off the fact that the show is called Small Town Mysteries, but I promise sometimes there is a specific intention to cover small towns. So we'd love to hear about your small town, or the one near you, or the one all the way across the country from you that has a case that you're hyperfixated on. We'd love to hear about it. So drop us a line at Small Town Mysteries Pod on Instagram. We'd love to hear from people. We love feedback and we love growing and learning with you guys. So we're coming up on 100 episodes, so I'm starting to get really sappy. But thank you guys for listening. Thank you all for taking the time out of your day to listen to this little passion project of ours and showing us your support through your listening. All right, we'll catch you on the flip side.
Come spiral with us next week.
Bye. Bye.